Welcome to Episode 2, Attack of the Clones. In this episode, R2 will be dispensing dating tips, Chewbacca will be telling us about the latest in hair care, and Darth Vader will be sharing his feelings. Just kidding, today we'll find out why Hermes is considered a phallic god, I'll talk about how spirituality is like a river and how religion is like an elephant, we'll have some breaking news including which Harry Potter character is gay, we have some poetry submitted by a listener, we'll find out about gay clones, and co-host Track makes his first appearance on the show talking about gay archetypes in mythology. This is the November 2007 episode, and Thanksgiving is coming up in the United States later this month, so if you hear any sound clips involving turkeys, that's why. I had hoped to include a review from Nightshade on gay horror movies by the director David Decoteau, and information on the quasi-pagan holiday of Moosemus, but those will have to wait for a later show, perhaps next month. Anyway, sit back and enjoy this month's show.
Here I am, 5 o'clock in the morning, stuffing breadcrumbs up a dead bird's butt.
Throughout history, in many cultures and traditions, homosexual men, as well as the transgendered and androgynous, have been considered sacred priests and intermediaries between the gods and mortals. Some have considered these people to be the most ideal candidates for shamans and healers. Native Americans honored and even revered as sacred and mystical men who do women's work and take on women's roles. Many gods and goddesses are reputed to have had homosexual priests. I believe the Greek Aphrodite and the Norse Frey and the Egyptian Isis are good examples. I tried to do an internet search to find out other examples, but kept getting drawn into Christian websites debating whether gay people should be allowed to be priests. What a difference in perspective. Many of the gods and goddesses themselves were homosexual, bisexual, transgendered, or androgynous. Besides the many Greek gods, the Norse Odin was said to cross-dress, the Hindu Ganesha was androgynous, and in Egypt, Set and Horus were said to have had oral intercourse. The honor and respect that some pagan religions have given to homosexuals is a stark contrast to Christianity, which has an inherent problem with not only homosexuality, but sexuality in general. I recently attended my local gay pride festival and was surprised to find about a dozen Christian groups for GLBT people, but no pagan ones. It just seems to me that it's like they're trying to fit a round shape into a square hole, or that they have that syndrome where someone who is tortured or imprisoned makes excuses for their oppressor. I mean, for many of us who have been beaten up by Christian attitudes toward homosexuality, or have beat ourselves up for believing them, it's really kind of like that. I looked it up. Stockholm Syndrome is a psychological response sometimes seen in an abducted hostage in which the hostage shows signs of loyalty to the hostage taker, regardless of the danger, or at least risk, in which the hostage has been placed. I mean, it's great that these people are aspiring to higher spirituality and trying to fix the negative attitudes in their respective religion, but it's really like trying to fix one of those old vacuum tube televisions with a box of integrated circuits. The television being Christianity and the integrated circuits being GLBT people, if you didn't catch my metaphor. With enough patience and enough rewiring, you can probably make it work. But is it really worth the trouble when you can go out and get a new television that fits you perfectly? I suppose a lot of people don't look for a new television set because they have sentimental attachments to their own television set. But they should expect that they won't always get the best reception, and they'll be constantly working to fix it. Those were more metaphors if you didn't notice. I don't really want to spend a lot of time knocking Christianity, because I think there are enlightened individuals in every religion who know the difference between higher spirituality and intolerance, and I think there are those in every religion that don't. My personal view on spirituality is that it's like this great big river of energy. Everybody can get a drink out of the river and taste it, but they only get a taste of one small bit of it. They get to experience a part of it, but the river itself is really too big for any one person to comprehend fully, and it's much too big to fit into any one religion. I think spirituality is this universal force of greater good, and religion is just how humans try to explain it and try to fit it into their worldviews. Religion is how people try to make sense out of the spiritual. There's this story I once heard about 6 blind men and an elephant that might also illustrate this concept. Since I'm on a roll with the metaphors, imagine the elephant as the universal force of spirituality. You can call it God or Goddess, the higher powers, the spiritual force of the universe, or whatever you consider to be the highest force of spirituality. Imagine the six blind men as followers of six different religions. So here goes the story. This is John Godfrey Saxe's version of a famous Indian legend. It was six men of Indostan, to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. The first approached the elephant, and happening to fall against his broad and sturdy side, at once began to bawl, "God bless me, but the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling of the tusk, cried, "Ho, what have we here? So very round and smooth and sharp. To me 'tis mighty clear. This wonder of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hands, thus boldly up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out an eager hand and felt about the knee. "What most this wondrous beast is like is mighty plain," quoth he. "'Tis clear enough the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "Even the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact who can. This marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth no longer had begun about the beast to grope, then seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indostan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion, exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right and all were in the wrong. And the moral of this story, so often in theologic wars, the disputants, I ween, rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean, and prate about an elephant not one of them has seen. And again, that was Saxe's poem that was published in 1878 in Linton's Poetry of America. And you can find that using a Google book search. In future episodes, I'd like to talk more on gay and bi-positive religions. Religions, gods, and goddesses that had or have gay priests, gay, bi, and sexually ambiguous gods and goddesses, and religions and traditions where gay, bi, and transgendered individuals were highly honored and respected. If you have knowledge of these and can back up the claim, please share by posting something about it on our Yahoo group. To join our Yahoo group, go to the Mail Mysteries webpage at http://melmysterry.matrixwerx.com. That's http://melmystery.matrixwerx.com. There's a link in the upper right-hand corner of the page to the Yahoo group. I'll try to highlight some of these gay-positive religions in future segments.
Dangerous and disturbing this puzzle is.
This month we have our first poetry contribution from Mark Hyers. He wrote, "A contribution. I wrote this in 1995, shortly after my Don passed away. It is about him, but more about how he affected the lives of those around him by just living. It's called Chinese Tea and Toast. It's all illusion, just a dream he'd expound to eager seekers of love and truth on autumn afternoons in Woodstock when the leaves had turned red and gold while serving Chinese tea and toast. He sang of wonders he'd never see, the silver cord and angel's wings. It's all delusion, a mindless game, he'd sing, his unconscious streaming like a rippling silver brook of meaning, singing into our ears and minds while serving Chinese tea and toast. He sang of love he'd never known, Mother Gaia and Herne, her son. We never know when we are loved, he'd sigh, radiantly seeking the beautiful love of cosmos, the eternal brother lover, while serving Chinese tea and toast." Thanks for the contribution, Mark. Mark has generously offered more poetry that he wrote for a gay pagan science fiction quarterly he was involved in the 1990s. If you'd like to submit your own poetry or music, please contact me through my email on the Mail Mysteries website.
I love a ritual sacrifice.
Not really a one of those.
To commemorate a past event, you kill and eat an animal. It's a ritual sacrifice with pie.
Gay gods.
This month, for the God and Mythology segment, I've decided to continue with the homoerotic trinity of Eros, Hermes, and Heracles. Last month, I talked about Eros, the patron of male-male love, and this month, I'm going to talk about Hermes. When people think of Hermes, also known by the Romans as Mercury, they think of a god associated with communication, travel, and boundaries, not to mention hermetic magic. But did you know that Greek god Hermes is a phallic god too? Before I get into that, I'd like to give you some background on this god. Besides the associations already mentioned, Hermes is considered a god of shepherds and cowherds, orators and wit, athletics, weights and measures, invention, commerce, and dreams. With his winged sandals and cap, Hermes is considered a messenger between the gods and mortals. He also serves as a psychopomp, an escort who leads the dead to the afterlife or underworld. He is only one of a few gods who could enter and leave the underworld at will. The others are Hades and Persephone. I can't pronounce that. Anyway, as an inventor, Hermes is said to have invented fire, musical instruments such as the lyre, and sports like racing and boxing. As a cunning trickster god, Hermes is considered a patron of liars and thieves. One of his most famous exploits was stealing Apollo's cattle on the very night of his birth. Hermes' symbols are the rooster and the tortoise. Besides his winged sandals and cap, he can be recognized by his staff, the caduceus, a winged staff with two snakes around it that today we associate with the medical professions. Originally, Hermes was depicted as an older, bearded, phallic god, but he was later depicted as an athletic youth with short, curly hair. He was often depicted nude, except for a robe draped over his shoulder or arm. Statues of the young Hermes stood in stadiums and gymnasiums throughout Greece. In fact, his realm included gymnastics, gymnastic games, and the gymnasium. His younger form depicted the Greek ideal of a handsome youth with a body harmoniously developed through athletic exercises and gymnastic excellence. Hermes' phallic associations came from the older statues called Hermes. These probably started with a custom whereby travelers added their own stones to wayside markers made of piles of stone. At some point, they were replaced with square or rectangular pillars with Hermes' bearded head and an erect phallus. The phallus was rubbed or anointed with olive oil for good luck. In some cases, the Herm was simply a carved phallus. Besides their traditional use as boundary markers, these were also placed outside houses in Athens for good luck. Hermes is associated with Wednesday, the planet Mercury, the element of air, communication, intelligence, and wit. Offerings of coins, wine, olive oil, and frankincense are considered appropriate to this god. As I did with Eros, I'm going to end this segment with an Orphic hymn to Hermes. To Hermes, fumigation from frankincense, Hermes, draw near, and to my prayer incline, messenger of Zeus and Maia's son divine, perfect of contest, ruler of mankind, with heart almighty and prudent mind, celestial messenger of various skill, whose powerful arts could watchful Argos kill, with winged feet, 'tis thine through air to course, O friend of man and prophet of discourse, great life supporter to rejoice is thine in arts gymnastic and in fraud divine, with power endued all language to explain, of care the loosener and the source of gain, whose hand contains of blameless peace the rod, Corticoian, blessed profitable god, of various speech whose aid in works we find, and in necessities to mortal kind, dire weapon of the tongue which men revere, be present, Hermes, and thy suppliant hear. Assist my works, conclude my life with peace, give graceful speech, and memories increase. That's Orphic Hymn 28 to Hermes. I also found this one online at the Temple of Hermes. It seems to be a modern translation of one of the Orphic hymns, but the website didn't cite which one. It really seemed to sum up Hermes' qualities, so I'm including this one also. Angel of Zeus, son of Maia, you judge every competition. Good shepherd, priest, and sage, celestial messenger of a thousand techniques. You lulled and slayed hundred-eyed Argos to give the peacock gorgeous feathers. Gracious prophet, guide, and guardian, you love gymnastics, secrets, and tricks. Giver of good things, ready helper, your gifts are casually found treasures. You give gain, honest or dishonest. Doorways, roads, and borders amuse you. Wings on your feet, you soar through space, singing all music in every language. With a touch of your wand, you bring sleep, a dream, or demise. We honor you, Hermes. Give us in our work. Give us eloquent speech and eager virility. Give us our necessities and sharp memory. Give us good luck. Close our lives in peace. We couldn't possibly have an episode called Attack of the Clones without bringing up the topic of gay clones.
They need a clone!
According to Wikipedia.org, a gay clone is a butch or masculine gay man. The term is mostly associated with the 1970s and 1980s. Clone uniform is a mustache, jeans, and a white t-shirt. In his book, Gay Macho, The Life and Death of the Homosexual Clone, the sociologist Martin Levine wrote this about the gay clone culture that began sometime in the 1970s and ended in the 1980s after the advent of AIDS. Long gone are the days of the macho man who had a trimmed beard, beautiful tan, muscled body, and an attitude that was above all attitudes. He wore tight Levi's, a harness over a bare chest, and light tan work boots. He told the world who he was and what he liked through certain actions and distinctive bits of clothing, such as a bandana, in either the right or left rear pocket. He danced with a frenzy to such songs as YMCA and I Want to Be a Macho Man. Those were the days when one went to the gay strips or bars to look, to watch, and cruise. The non-macho man stared with envy at the macho man he longed to be. These were the clones. Everyone who had a body wanted to be one, and those who did not have a body spent hours at the gym trying to attain that body. The disco was in and wild, and the leather bars were full, and the dark back bars with their secret codes for entrance were in every major city. There were four qualities that marked clones: strong masculine, blue-collar dress and mannerisms, unrestrained recreational sex with multiple partners, the use of alcohol and recreational drugs, and they partied hard, frequenting discos and bars. The clone culture was a rejection of the effeminate stereotype of gay men that has pervaded most of history. The clone was super manly and had more in common with the Marlboro Man than the stereotypical gay hairdressers and florists. At the time, the gay media glorified the clone, and the clone came to symbolize the liberated gay man. As much as these men came to symbolize gay liberation, they didn't exactly get the freedom they came to epitomize. Instead, gay clone culture developed its own sets of rules and norms to enforce its own sense of conformity. These men moved from the rigid world of enforced heterosexuality that pervaded earlier times to a new equally rigid culture where conformity to the clone ideals ruled. In another book titled Out for Good, The Struggle to Build a Gay Rights Movement in America, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the author's names, but they stated that the streets of San Francisco offered, in theory at least, a cross-section of America's male homosexual community, but one would never know that to walk down Castro Street. All these men looked identical, with their short haircuts, clipped mustaches, and muscular bodies, turned out in standard-issue uniforms of tight faded jeans and polo shirts. The image was one part military, one part cowboy, one part 1950s suburbia and conformity, and they swaggered down the street, men aloof and unfriendly, as if their affected distance enhanced their masculinity. In the end, the clone lifestyle, with its emphasis on alcohol, drugs, and anonymous sex, turned into the perfect breeding ground for AIDS and was literally wiped out. Or was it? I'd like to pose the question of whether we've really become that much more liberated as gay men in the past 20 to 30 years. Have we really traded our conformity to heterosexual norms and values to something that is truly and uniquely our own, with our fight for gay marriage and by embracing the family values rhetoric that was used against us only a decade ago? How many gay events now profess themselves to be kid-friendly or family-friendly? Have we really traded heterosexual conformism for a true value of diversity and uniqueness, when depending on what bar you go to, everyone is pigeonholed into some particular niche, whether the Abercrombie boys, the Leathermen, the drag queens? How often do members of these groups give each other the same aloof and unfriendly stares that the clones gave everyone? When we plan or attend gay events, do we tend to marginalize those who are not like us? Perhaps the overly effeminate, the drag queens, or the transgendered. Perhaps it's just human nature for it to be us versus them, for us to identify with those like us and to marginalize those who are not. Perhaps it's just human nature for people to try to make rules for others to conform to, whether through religion or through the norms of social groups. Are we simply striving to be clones of the dominant mainstream culture, or even our specific gay or bi subculture? Trying to live, to act, and to be like everyone else? Are we simply living by the same norms and values because it's what we've been taught, or what we've become accustomed to, or what is expected of us? Or are we striking out on our own, sometimes scary and untrodden path to define ourselves, to determine our own morals and values, to determine our own types of relationships, even our own religions and spiritual paths, and ultimately finding the truths within ourselves?
Oh my God, it's finally happened. You've gotten so gay, you've looped around to straight again.
In case you didn't notice in that last segment, I'm starting to develop a bit of a sore throat, so I'm going to go ahead and turn the microphone over to Track for a while. Track is going to tell us a bit about gay archetypes and mythology, and then he's going to expound a bit more on Hermes as a gay god.
Good evening. My name is Track. I'm here to talk to you today about gay and bisexual archetypes in classical mythology. If you haven't been wondering where they are, there's a good reason. You usually don't find a whole lot in today's classical mythology. But isn't mythology timeless? Isn't the myth that we've been told since childhood the same myth that were written by the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians so long ago? No, sadly not. A few people have tried to write books about them, but no one has come forward to write in length about the gay and bisexual archetypes. Almost all of the better books on sexual individuation are strictly written from a heterosexual point of view. Two examples which come to mind are June Singer's Androgyny Towards a New Theory of Sexuality and Edward C. Whitmont's Return of the Goddess. The erotic minorities aren't simply expressing paranoia when they complain that their myths have been ignored at best or misappropriated at worst by straight patriarchal society. The disposition of gay and bisexual archetypes has been going on for a long, long time and shows no sign of cessation. Since Frazier's Golden Bough, the mythologists have focused their attention upon strictly Osirian deities, markedly heterosexual and procreative, while the new eon's pansexual gods have received scant attention. Open any book on classical mythology and you will see how the homosexual or bisexual component of male deities has been swept aside or glossed over, necessitating a habit of reading between the lines. First, there's the ongoing conspiracy on the part of the heterosexual occultist to deny the erotic minorities an esoteric tradition of their own. It ranges from snide remarks in pagan publications, such as, and I quote, "Homosexuals cannot be witches. We want no kinks in our circle," unquote. And it goes all the way to unenlightened pronouncements in such popular works as Sexual Secrets, The Alchemy of Ecstasy by N. Douglas and Penny Slinger, who had the audacity to argue in the 20th century that gays should seek solutions to their problems instead of campaigning for wider acceptance. In Magic and Theory and Practice, Crowley wrote that in order to fully appreciate the maternity of Isis, the magician would do well to cultivate those female virtues in which he is deficient, without in any ways impairing his virility. I find that last part just a little odd, but considering that Crowley was to some extent a product of his times, and that he lived during the Victorian era, we should not be surprised that he was somewhat self-oppressed by his bisexuality. After all, he was well aware of the shameless and disgraceful treatment of England's most notorious sodomite, the 19th century novelist and playwright Oscar Wilde. I believe that the time has come for the sexual minorities to rediscover and reclaim their archetypes, a process made only possible by systematically stripping the myths of heterosexual gloss and examining them in their original context. Apollo was enamored of Hyacinth. Oh dear, he was absolutely smitten with a lad, and that their homosexual relationship was one in which the couple mirrors each other. I believe that this type of relationship, in which one sees oneself in another, represents self-acceptance. I think that's what we can all see a little bit more of ourselves in that. Robert Graves describes Ganymede as the most beautiful youth alive. Homer in the Iliad, Virgil in the Aeneid, and Ovid in the Metamorphoses all tell how Jupiter, disguising himself as an eagle, abducted the boy and flew him to Mount Olympus. There is something homosexual in Zeus's promise that Ganymede will be exempt from old age and its attendant ills. and the gay subculture youth is put at a premium, which fact did not escape a Wilde. His Dorian Gray, even the character's name is charged with symbolism, is presented with a portrait of himself only to find that while he remains young and handsome, the figure in the painting ages. Although one suspects that every person, gay or straight, would like to remain eternally pure, the dream is actually cherished by gays. As cupbearer or wine pourer to the gods, Ganymede symbolizes an archetype. The often seen bartender in the gay watering holes, young and svelte and outgoing, Graves notes that the Greeks embraced the myth of Zeus and Ganymede with great passion, since it legitimized pederastic love. Any exegesis of gay and bisexual archetypes in my world would have to include Dionysius, who probably of all the gods comes closest to symbolizing the reintegration of his anima, which did not escape the previously mentioned tune singer. This may have been foreordained by Hermes having stipulated that Ino, the true white goddess, raised the boy as a girl. Now whether, as some claim, this was to fool Hera, who was jealous of Zeus's dalliance with the child's mother, Semele, or merely one of Hermes' celebrated tricksterish pranks, I cannot say. In any case, Aeschylus, Euripides, and the ancient writers describe Dionysius as womanly or man-womanish. It is of critical importance, however, that the mythological Dionysius grew to manhood not as an effete drag queen, but as a virile adventurer and husband to Ariadne. Very little is made by most mythologists of his relationship to the greatest of all satyrs, Silenus, who was Dionysius' mentor. A famous piece of sculpture, however, depicts their relationship as anything but platonic. There are overtones of pedophilia in the satyr's leer. In the development of his cultus, Dionysius is depicted as mad and frenzied, followed everywhere by ecstatic women, the Bacchae. Who hasn't identified the late Jim Morrison, lead singer for The Doors, as archetypically Dionysian? But his books and movies about Morrison make abundantly clear his androgynous appearance was deceptive, since he was strictly straight. Chiron, the centaur, had a fling with Heracles, whom we know as Hercules. Castor and Pollux enjoyed themselves incestuously, and the immortal love of Damon for Philia has been trivialized into something akin to a close friendship. Phaeton was so mourned by his mortal lover, classical mythology abounds in instances of euphemism, that he was turned into a swan, giving rise to our phrase, swan song. I could make a good case for an affair between Apollo and Hermes, and another for a dalliance by Apollo and Cicadas, or Marisus, and of course the biblical loves of David and Jonathan in the Old Testament, and Jesus and John in the New Testament are quite well known. Truth be told, in the ranks of classical mythology, figures, gay, bisexual, and lesbian, abound, but they're seldom noticed. Achilles, Apollo, Dionysius, Euryalus, Ganymede, Gilgamesh, the Sumerian semi-divine hero, ruler, king of Uruk, who, the god of creation, all prominent gay archetypes. We need more.
This month, I have some interesting news items to report. First of all, for those of you who have not heard, Hogwarts wizard Albus Dumbledore is gay. Last month, while appearing at Carnegie Hall in New York, Rowling was asked if Dumbledore finds true love. "Dumbledore is gay," Rowling explained. "Dumbledore was smitten with rival wizard Gellert Grindelwald, whom he defeated long ago in a battle between good and bad wizards. Falling in love can blind us to some extent, and Dumbledore's love was a great tragedy." Another news item. Fred Phelps, the notorious homophobe known for protesting the funerals of gay persons and AIDS victims, has been fined $10.9 million for demonstrating at the March 2006 funeral of Lance Matthew Snyder, who was killed in Iraq. Phelps and members of his Westboro Baptist Church routinely picket the funerals of personnel killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, carrying signs such as "Thank God for Dead Soldiers" and "God Hates Fags." It seems that Muslims aren't the only group with religious extremists. And this last piece of news has nothing to do with gay people or religion, but it makes me all giddy inside. For those of you who don't know, I'm a big Knight Rider fan, trying to convert my beat-up 1982 Trans Am into a shiny and state-of-the-art kit conversion. Earlier this week, I was terribly disappointed to be outbid on eBay for some electronics conversion parts I need for my car. But all was not lost, because the very next day I found this news article online. NBC has tapped soap star Justin Bruning to front a new Knight Rider TV movie that could serve as a pilot to a revived series based on the 1980s action adventure about a crime fighter and his talking Trans Am. This time out, the younger Knight's ride will feature more aftermarket mods, perhaps even morphing into a Transformers-like bot. The make and model of the new vehicle hasn't been announced, though NBC is seeking an automaker to partner with for the retooled kit. There's also talk of a big screen Knight Rider movie coming out next year. Anyway, that's the news.
It takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to your enemies, but a great deal more to stand up to your friends.
A Herb of Gratitude by Sanayan. I sing of Hermes, the slayer of Argos, lord of Kyllene, an Arcadia rich in flocks, luck-bringing messenger of the deathless gods, giver of grace, guide, and granter of happy boons. Such is how the 18th Homeric hymn praises Hermes, and as many can attest from personal experience, it is a very apt description. Of all the gods, Hermes is perhaps the closest to mankind. He is constantly depicted as putting on a human guise and walking among us, working his strange magic and causing the unexpected to occur. He is a god of the crossroads, where two points meet and the road diverges into unfamiliar territory. Chance, coincidence, synchronicity, luck, an accident so full of meaning it ceases to be arbitrary. We have many ways to describe the hermetic process in our lives, and it can be felt in an equally abundant variety of manifestations. For Hermes has taken upon himself many offices. His realms include everything having to do with money and finances, with commerce and exchange, with thievery and clever ideas, with communication and logic, both expressed as clear thinking and cunning deceit, with travel and exploration, with social bonds and their transgressions, and ultimately everything that has to do with the human world and what lies beyond it. Hermes is fond of surprising us. When we're agonizing over which bill we will have to go unpaid this month, he drops a windfall into our laps. When we're feeling that our life has lost its moorings and we're drifting aimlessly along, he'll cause our eyes to flash upon a billboard with a message that seems to have been written just for us. Sometimes Hermes' changes can be drastic and frightening. A long-time relationship suddenly crumbles, or the job that we were sure we were going to get falls through. At such times, it is easy to get discouraged and even to become angry at our lot in life. But if we don't lose heart and continue pressing on, often we will find that this happened for a reason. Another person, better able to meet our needs, steps into the fore. That job we thought looked so promising is actually a dead end that would have sapped our spirit and left us feeling trapped and bitter. Hermes is an amazing god, and the more you look for his presence in your life, the more it will be found. But sometimes that can prove difficult. It is easy to get caught up in the things and lose our focus, especially when our lives are so hectic and fast-paced, and we have to juggle a dozen things at any given moment. While Hermes' presence can be announced with colorful fireworks and life-altering events, more often than not, he acts in subtle, easily misled ways behind the scenes. Just as anyone who works so hard to make our lives better and run smoother, when he's not throwing a monkey wrench into things for his own amusement, that is, he appreciates it when we take note of their benefactions. Hermes likes it when we honor him in a spirit of gratitude. This can take a number of different forms. Obviously, there's the lavish sacrifice and votive gifts, which form such an important part of Hellenic polytheist religious practice. Additionally, there are small devotional activities that we can perform for him, such as writing poetry or making crafts to please him, or showing kindness to random strangers on the street, or donating time and money to worthy charities in his honor. And there is always the solid standby of prayers or even spontaneous expressions of gratitudes of, wow, thanks for, and insert whatever would fit right in there. All these are fine examples, and I would heartily commend their adoption. But lately I've been thinking of another way that I could express my gratitude to the god, one that is more permanent and concrete, and I would like to share with you today. Appropriately enough for a devotional rite dedicated to Hermes, I stole the idea for this from Philip, the doctor of the Ecclesia Antonia, who performed a similar rite during the Antonius ritual in the Pantheon this year. I would just like to take a moment to publicly thank him before we proceed. You see, in ancient times, people used to set up herms by the wayside to mark important boundaries. These were piles of stones, sometimes with a pillar erected in the middle, which had been built up over the years, each traveler setting a rock on his pile as he passed by. Scholars speculate that Hermes acquired his name from this practice, being originally the guardian of such numinous places. Reflecting on this practice, I figured it might be a wonderful way to show our continual gratitude to the god. The practice, as I envision it, consists of this. Every time you feel thankful to Hermes for something, pick up a rock or a pebble. Using a permanent marker, a magic marker would be indeed appropriate considering that Hermes is the patron of the magical arts, inscribe it with some type of dedication. Depending on the size of your stone, this could be a date or a single word to remind you of the event, or even a small paragraph describing what happened. Afterwards, place the stone in a bowl which you keep in a special place, such as a shrine, and every time you pass by, you will have a tangible reminder of that event. Once your bowl is full, take the pile of stones outside, in your yard, or to a park, or toward an abandoned city lot, or some wooded location, or at a crossroads, or a roadside of a highway, and set them in a mound as a herm of gratitude. Thus you will have erected a monument to the god in consecrated territory for him, and left a physical representation of your gratitude. And who knows, depending on where you set it up, somebody at a later date may stumble upon it, perhaps leading them to seek out more information about this god, and who knows, they may even end up cultivating a relationship with him just because of your example. It will also be a continual act of devotion that can help ground you and remind you of his presence and his many blessings in your life. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Discovering the Male Mysteries with Mel Mystery podcast. You can find out more information about the show, its hosts, and find a link to our Yahoo group by going to http://melmystery.matrixwerx.com. That's http://melmystery.matrixwerx.com. If you would like to submit original poetry or music, suggest a topic, or guest host a future segment, you can find information on how to do so, including a way to email me, on the Mail Mysteries website.
Remember, the Force will be with you always.